My Lord Intef seemed not to notice my distress. He was too concerned with his own immediate interests, and he went on speaking. Before I gave my formal consent to the union, I prevailed on the king to concede that if she bore him a son, then he would elevate my daughter to the rank of principal wife and queen consort. He clapped his hands in unrestrained triumph. Of course, you realize what that means. If Pharaoh should die before my grandson is of age to rule, then I, as his grandfather and closest male line, would become regent. He broke off suddenly and stared at me, and I knew him so well that I understood exactly what was running through his mind. He was bitterly regretting that indiscretion. Nobody should ever have heard that thought expressed. It was purest treason. If Lostris bore a son to Pharaoh, then the father would not live long thereafter. We both understood that. My Lord Intef had given notice to regicide, and he was considering removing the only one who had heard it spoken, the humble slave Taita. We both understood that clearly. My lord, I am only grateful that it has turned out the way I planned it. I admit now that I have worked deviously to place your daughter in the king's way, and that I described her to him as the mother of his future son. I used the pageant as a showpiece to focus his attention upon her. However, I could not bring myself to speak to you of such momentous affairs until they had been successfully engineered. But there still remains a great deal for us to do before we can count ourselves secure. And I began swiftly to extemporize a list of all that might go awry before he could gain control of the crown and the golden scepter of Egypt. Tactfully, I made it clear how much he still needed me if he were to achieve his design. I saw him relax as he followed my arguments, and I knew that at least for the immediate future, I was safe. It was some time before I could reasonably escape from his presence and hurry to warn my Lady Lostris of the terrible predicament in which I had placed her. However, before I reached her door, I realized that my warning to her would serve no purpose other than to distress her to the point of dementia or even suicide. I could waste no further time if I were to prevent events from rushing to their tragic conclusion. There was only one person to whom I could turn now. I left the necropolis and set off along the towpath of the canal back towards the riverbank where I knew that Tanos' squadrons were encamped. The moon was only 3 days from full, and it lit the jagged hills of the western horizon with a cold yellow radiance and threw black shadows on the plain below. As I hurried along, I recited to myself a full list of all the possible calamities and misfortunes that might befall Tanos, my Lady Lostris, and myself in the days ahead. I was goading myself the same way that a black-maned desert lion lashes up his temper with the bony spike in the end of his tail before he charges at the huntsman. Thus I was in fulminating mood long before I reached the bank of the Nile. I found Tanos' encampment without difficulty, hard by the bank of the Nile at the mouth of the canal. The ships of the squadron were anchored below the camp. The sentries challenged me, and then, when they recognized me, led me to Tanos' tent. Tanos was at late supper with Kratos and four other of his subordinate officers. He rose to greet me with a smile and offered me the beer tankard in his hand. "This is such an unexpected pleasure, old friend. Sit down beside me and have a pull of my beer while my slave brings you a cup and platter. You look hot and out of sorts." I cut short these pleasantries by rounding on him furiously. "To Seth with you, you great senseless oaf. Do you not understand what jeopardy you have placed us in, you and that flapping jawbone of yours? Do you have no thought for the safety and well-being of my mistress?" In truth, I had not meant to be so harsh on him. But once I had started, it seemed that I was unable to control my emotions, and all my fear and anxiety came tumbling out in a flood of invective. Not all that I accused him of was true or fair, but it made me feel better to have it out. Tanos' expression changed, and he held up one hand as though to shield himself. "Whoa! You take me unawares. I am unarmed and unable to defend myself from such a murderous assault." In front of his officers, his tone was jocular, but his smile was thin as he seized my arm and steered me out of the tent into the darkness, and half dragged me beyond the regimental lines into the open moonlit fields beyond. I was like a child in the grip of that right hand that was trained to wield the sword and draw the great bow, Lanata. "Now puke it up," he ordered me grimly. "What has happened to put you in such vile humour?" I was still angry, but more afraid than angry, and my tongue took flight again. "I have spent half my life trying to protect you from your own stupidity, and I am sick of it. Don't you understand anything of life? Did you truly believe that you would be allowed to escape unscathed from the incredible folly into which you threw all of us last night? Are you talking about my declamation at the pageant? He looked puzzled, and released the crushing grip on my arm. How can you say it was folly? All my officers and every other person I have spoken to since then are all delighted with what I had to say. You fool! Don't you see that the opinions of all your officers and all your friends count for the price of a rotten fish in the scheme of things? Under any other ruler, you would already be dead, and even this weak and vacillating old man of ours cannot afford to let you escape the consequences of your insolence. It is more than his throne is worth. There will be a bill for you to pay, Tunnus, Lord Harrop. Horace knows it will be a heavy bill. You are speaking in riddles, he snapped at me. I did the king a great service. He is surrounded by fawning toadies who feed him the lies they think he wants to hear. It was past time that he learned the truth, and I know in my heart that once he considers it, he will be grateful to me. My anger began to evaporate before his simple and steadfast belief in the triumph of good. Tunnus, my dearest friend, what an innocent you are. No man is ever grateful for having the unpalatable truth rammed down his throat, but apart from that, you have played directly into the hands of my Lord Intef. My Lord Intef? He stared at me hard. What of my Lord Intef? You speak of him as though he were my enemy. The Grand Vizier was my father's dearest friend. I know that I can trust him to protect me. He swore an oath to my father as he lay on his deathbed. I could see that despite his sunny disposition and our friendship, he was becoming truly angry with me, probably for the first time in his life. I knew also that although it was slow to rouse, Tanus' anger was something to fear. Oh, Tanus, I curbed my own anger at last. I have been unfair to you. There is so much that I should have told you and never did. Nothing was as you thought it. I was a coward, but I could not tell you that Intef was your father's deadliest enemy. How can this be true? Tunnus shook his head. They were friends, the dearest friends. My earliest memories are of them laughing together. My father told me that I could trust my very life to my Lord Intef. The noble Pianchi Lord Harrop believed that. It is true. His faith cost him his entire fortune, and in the end his life, which he placed in Intef's hands. No, you must be mistaken. My father was the victim of a series of misfortunes, and every one of those misfortunes was engineered by my Lord Intef. He envied your father for his virtues and his popularity, for his wealth and his influence with Pharaoh. He realized that Lord Harrop would be appointed Grand Vizier before him, and he hated him for all these things. I cannot believe you. I cannot bring myself to believe you. Tunnus shook his head in denial. And the last of my anger was snuffed out. I will explain it all to you. As I should have done long ago, I will give you all the proof you need. But there is no time for it now. You must trust me. My Lord Intef hates you even as he hated your father. Both you and my Lady Lostris are in danger. In danger of more than simply life itself. In danger of losing each other forever. But how is that possible, Taita? He was confused and shaken by my words. I thought that my Lord Intef had agreed to our union. Have you not spoken to him, then? Yes, I have spoken to him, I cried, and I seized Tunnus' hand and thrust it up under the back of my tunic. That was his reply. Feel the welts left by the lash. He had me flogged for even suggesting the marriage between you and my Lady Lostris. That is how much he hates you and your family. Tunnus stared at me speechlessly. But I saw that he believed me at last, and so I was able to come to the subject that was dominating my thoughts more even than his intemperate speech, or the vendetta that the Grand Vizier had conducted so successfully against him over so many years. Hear me now, my dear friend, and brace yourself for the very worst tidings yet. There was no other way to tell him, except as directly as Tunnus would have told me. Far from agreeing to your marriage, my Lord Intef has this very night pledged his daughter's hand to another. She is to be married immediately to Pharaoh Mamoza, and after she bears his first son, she will become his principal wife and consort. The king will make the announcement himself at the end of the festival of Osiris. The marriage will take place that very same evening. Tunnus swayed on his feet, and in the moonlight his face turned ghostly pale. Neither of us could speak for a long while, and then Tunnus turned away from me and walked out along the field of standing corn. I trailed behind him, keeping him in sight, until at last he found an outcrop of black rock and seated himself upon it with the weary air of a very old man. I came up softly and seated myself below him. Deliberately I remained silent until he sighed and asked quietly, "Has Lostris consented to this marriage?" "Of course not. As yet she probably knows nothing about it. But do you think for one moment that her objections would count against the will of her father and the king? She will have no say in the matter." "What are we to do, old friend?" Even in my distress, I was grateful to him that he had used the plural, including me, reassuring me of our friendship. "There is one other probability that we must face," I warned him, "and that is that in the same speech that Pharaoh announces his betrothal to Lostris, he will order your imprisonment, or worse still, issue your death warrant. My lord Intef has the king's ear, and he will certainly put him up to it. In truth, he would have good reason. You are certainly guilty of sedition." "I do not care to live without Lostris as my wife. If the king takes her from me, then he is welcome to my head as a marriage gift." He said it simply, without histrionics, so that I had difficulty in feigning anger and putting the edge of contempt into my voice. "You sound like a weak and pitiful old woman giving herself up to the fates without a struggle. What a fine and undying love is yours, if you will not even fight for her." "How do you fight a king and a god?" Tunnus asked quietly. "A king to whom you have sworn allegiance? And a god who is as remote and as unassailable as the sun?" "As a king, he does not deserve your allegiance. You set that out clearly in your declamation. He is a weak and dithering old man who has divided the two kingdoms and brought our Tamari bleeding to her knees." "And as a god?" Tunnus again asked quietly, as though he were not really interested in the answer, although I knew him to be a devout and religious man, as so many great warriors are. "A god?" made my tone derisive. "You have more of the godhead in your sword arm than he has in all his soft little body." "Then what do you suggest?" he asked with deceptive mildness. "What would you have me do?" I drew a deep breath and then blurted it out. "Your officers and your men would follow you to the gates of the underworld. The populace love you for your courage and your honour." I faltered, for his expression in the moonlight gave me no encouragement to continue. He was silent for 20 beats of my racing heart, and then he ordered me softly, "Go on, say what you have to say. Tunnus, you would make the noblest pharaoh that this Tamari, this motherland, has known for 1,000 years. You, with my lady Lostris on the throne beside you, could lead this land and this people back to greatness. Call out your squadrons and lead your men down the causeway to where the unworthy pharaoh lies, unprotected and vulnerable. By dawn tomorrow you could be ruler of the upper kingdom. By this time next year you could have defeated the usurper and have reunited the kingdoms." I leapt to my feet and faced him. "Tunnus, Lord Harab, your destiny and that of the woman you love await you. Seize them both in your strong warrior's hands." "Warrior's hands, yes." He held them up before my face. "Hands that have fought for my motherland and have protected her rightful king." "You do me a disservice, old friend. They are not the hands of a traitor, nor is this the heart of a blasphemer that would seek to cast down and destroy a god and take his place in the pantheon." I groaned aloud in my frustration. "You would be the greatest pharaoh of the last 500 years, and you need not proclaim your godhead. Not if the idea offends you. Do it, I beseech you, for the sake of this very Egypt of ours, and of the woman that we both love." "Would Lostris still love a traitor, as she loved a soldier and a patriot?" "I think not." He shook his head. "She would love you no matter what," I began. But he cut me short. "You cannot convince me. She is a woman of virtue and of honour. As a traitor and a thief, I would forfeit all right to her respect. What is of equal importance, I would never respect myself again, or consider myself worthy of her sweet love, if I did what you urge. Speak of it no more, as you value our friendship. I have no claim to the double crown, nor will I ever make such claim. Horace, hear me, and turn your face away from me if ever I should break this pledge."